most 510K devices, in fact, do not need clinical data. But if you are going to need clinical data, even if it's a non-significant risk device, as we talked about before, I think you're wise to vet that with the FDA in a pre-sub in advance first, even though you're not required to. Some companies take the attitude, well, we don't want to create a problem where none exists. And so they'll say, well, we're not going to we're not going to tell FDA about that. Well, I say, okay, fine, that's your decision. You don't have to. But here's the risk that you're taking. If you're going to do a clinical trial for your NSR device and you don't tell FDA about it first, and again, you have no obligation to, and you spring it on them for the first time at the point of the submission, then be prepared for them coming back and say, well, you know, what about this other endpoint? You didn't measure this endpoint. You know, we would like to see that. So now you may have to do a whole clinical trial over again in order to collect that information. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. You know, it's a calculated risk. Some companies might choose to take that risk. Other companies might not.
Welcome to the Global Medical Device Podcast, where today's brightest minds in the medical device industry go to get their most useful and actionable insider knowledge direct from some of the world's leading medical device experts and companies.
Attention medical device innovators, are you tired of the challenges and inefficiencies of managing clinical study data? It's time to revolutionize your process with Greenlight Guru's state-of-the-art electronic data capture system. Designed specifically for the medical device industry, Greenlight Guru's EDC system simplifies your clinical data management from start to finish. Our platform enables you to efficiently capture, manage, and analyze your clinical data all in one secure and user-friendly environment. With Greenlight Guru's EDC system, you can centralize your clinical data in a single, compliant, and easily accessible platform. Reduce study setup time by up to 80% with pre-built templates and automated workflows. Ensure data integrity and compliance with 21 CFR Part 11 and HIPAA requirements. And make informed decisions with real-time insights into study progress and powerful analytics and reporting tools. With our expert customer success team by your side, you'll have the support and guidance you need to ensure your clinical studies are a resounding success. Don't let cumbersome clinical data management hold you back. Visit www.greenlight.guru today to learn how Greenlight Guru's electronic data capture system can streamline your clinical studies and help you bring your medical device to market faster and with greater confidence. That's www.greenlight.guru, your partner in clinical study success. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Global Medical Device Podcast. My name is Etienne Nichols. I'm the host for today's episode. Today with us is Dr. Mike Drews, likely a familiar voice that you've heard on the podcast previously, but just to kind of recap a few additional things from 2023, this being recorded in early 2024. One of the cool things about Mike Drews and having him on the podcast is Mike is one of the top 24 medtech voices to follow in 2024, according to the MD plus DI, MDDI, their article, and we'll put a link to that so you can see who else to follow as well. In addition to that, Mike's was the number one and number two podcast for 2023, number one being the FDA guidance on artificial intelligence and medical devices, and number two being avoiding potential issues with your 510K submission. We'll put links to both of those in the show notes. In addition to that, he was in the top 10 webinars for 2023. And if you've ever seen one of Mike's webinars, you can understand why. He gives a lot of information, a lot of resources, and a lot of actionable tips and things that you can truly apply. So we'll put a link to that as well. But that webinar was Complaint Handling, How to Avoid the Number 3 Most Cited Reason for 483 Observations. And lastly, he was in the most popular medical device content in 2023 for Greenlight Guru. And you know, we put a lot of content out. So that is up there in the top echelons of the content that we produce. So first of all, Mike, I'd like to thank you for all of your contributions from 2023. And I'd especially like to thank you for being on the podcast today.
Well, thank you, Eddie. And it's always a pleasure. And I look forward to continuing to work together in 2024. And just to give credit where credit is due, you were kind enough to mention that I was in the one of the top 24 of people, medical device people to listen to in 2024 by MDDI magazine. Well, you were in that list as well. So
yeah, I don't always know how or why these things happen, but it's fantastic. And I love to be among the stars. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you for bringing that up. Thank you for mentioning that. And again, thank you for being on the podcast. IRB, Institutional Review Board. First of all, maybe we should talk about what is an IRB. Maybe we should start there.
Yeah, great question, Eddie. And as always, thank you for the opportunity to have this important discussion with you and your audience today. This is one of the many common questions that I get from my customers as they develop medical devices, especially if clinical data is going to be involved in a clinical trial, for example. They'll ask me, do we need FDA's approval to begin the clinical trial? Do we need IRB's approval to begin a clinical trial? And because this is such a commonly asked question, I thought it would be a good topic of conversation for one of our podcasts. So the short answer to your question of what is an institutional review board or IRB, simply put, it's the way I like to think of it, Eddie, and it's a backup. It's a sanity check to the FDA. In other words, mechanistically, an IRB is typically made up of a handful of people, typically about five or six members, both a mix of scientific and medical folks, as well as you have to have at least one non-medical folk. Unlike the FDA that has responsibility across the entire country, the IRB is local. It has responsibility only to that particular hospital or medical school or institution or whatever it is that they're representing. And as a general rule, we'll talk more about this in a moment, but as a general rule, if you're going to do a clinical trial for a new medical device, you have to have the IRB's permission. Some people call it approval, but it's really not an approval in the FDA sense of the word, but you have to have their permission. And then sometimes, not always, but sometimes you need to have the FDA's permission to begin the clinical trial as well. We'll come back to that in just a moment. But here's a not so hypothetical question for you, Eddie. And let's say that you're going to do a clinical trial at, say, three different sites across the country. For the sake of names, how about if we say Harvard and Hopkins and Stanford? All right, so you want to do a clinical trial of your new medical device at these three institutions. How many groups, how many approvals or how many, you know, OKs would you need to get to begin that trial?
Well, based on what you just said, it sounds like you need at least three, one from each one of those institutions.
Correct. You need to have one of each of those three institutions. So in this case, you know, Harvard, Hopkins, Stanford, you'd need each one. And by the way, the decisions of the IRB are independent of the FDA. They're also independent of one another. So it's possible, for example, for the, and I'm only using those names because most people have heard of them, but it's possible that Hopkins and Stanford IRB say, yeah, no problem, go ahead and begin the clinical trial. But Harvard, for whatever reason, may not be comfortable with that. So it is possible, it doesn't happen often, but it is possible that you might get disagreement between the IRBs. That's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, that's part of the medical safe check and balance system, if you will. And the decisions are also independent of the FDA as well. So it's possible for the IRB to say yes and the FDA to say no, or vice versa. So there's a lot of different possibilities, and I have a few scenarios I can share as we continue about what to do in these different situations. But does that at least answer the question of what is an IRB?
It does. I am curious, just kind of an offshoot of what you just said. What about the standardization across IRBs? Not so much that you get a yes if Stanford says yes, Harvard will say yes. That's not what I'm talking about, but just a standardized approach, knowing that there may be differences in the interpretation of that standardization. Are there any things like that?
Yes, the shorter answer is absolutely. That is, we've talked about before, Eddie, and is endemic across all regulation, not just IRBs. Technically speaking, IRBs are supposed to be following the GCPs, the good clinical practices. But just like any regulation, that regulation can be interpreted in many, many different ways. So why don't we just so that we don't have to talk in generalities and platitudes, let's take a specific example. This is an example that I was involved with a few years ago. We had a product. Technically, this was a combination product because it involved stem cell, but it doesn't matter. So a couple of the IRBs said, yes, no problem. One IRB said no. So in that kind of a scenario, Eddie, what do you think the company's choices are to do? If one IRB says no, what are their options?
Well, I mean, if there's three, I guess you could proceed with the two. And I'm just thinking of different options. One may be, well, I'll just take this to another institution and see if I can get another institution to okay it, or I could alter my test.
Yeah, that's, you know, coming from somebody who's sort of a self-proclaimed novice about this, I think you know more about it than you're giving yourself credit to. Those are the two options that the company has. You can try to work with the IRB to try to address whatever concerns they have, or at the end of the process, if that particular IRB, for whatever reason, is being difficult, then you can do what we call IRB shopping. In other words, you can shop around. You can say, okay, Harvard, as much as we would like to work with you, you know what? Quite frankly, you're just being too difficult. And it's not worth it. We're going to go down the road to, you know, to Yale or to Cornell or to NYU or something like that. So this is something called IRB shopping. And by the way, the same thing happens sort of in the regulatory world. It's what I call notified body shopping. You know, in the EU, for example, you're required to work with a notified body. But it doesn't say, nor should it say, which one you need to work with. So if you're working with one and for whatever reasons you're not getting the satisfaction that you think you should be getting, there's nothing from preventing you to shopping to a different notified body. So the regulatory logic, you know, the precedent here is the same. But going back to my scenario that I described a moment ago, it turned out that the one institution that was quite frankly being obstinate about this. And remember, the key variable here is that the device involves stem cells. One of the requirements of IRBs is that you have to have a non-technical member of that IRB. In other words, not a physician or an engineer or you know, a scientist or something. It has to be a non-technical person. Of course, different institutions interpret what non-technical means in different ways. But in this particular case, it was a measure. It was one of the people was a member of the clergy. Well, long story short, there ain't nothing that we're going to say to get this person to agree with a stem cell clinical trial. So the first attempt is to try to work with the IRB, if at all possible, just like work with the FDA, if at all possible, to try to resolve whatever differences that you have to come up with what the attorneys like to call a meeting of the minds. If in spite of your best attempts, you can't do that, then the other option, as you just pointed out, Etienne, is to shop around for somebody else, a different institution. You know, this is what we call IRB shopping. And just to peel back the onion on that a tiny bit further, Etienne, there's two types of IRBs. There's what I call a traditional IRB, and that's the one that people are most familiar with. That's the one that exists at that particular institution. So, you know, Hopkins will have their own IRB. Stanford will have their own IRB. Harvard will have their own IRB. And by the way, in the case of these very, very large institutions, they usually have multiple IRBs. They might have one IRB for cardiovascular products, another IRB for urology products, a third for gastrointestinal, and so on. So that depends on the organization. Those are all the traditional IRBs. But then the other option that some institutions will recognize is what we call a commercial IRB. A commercial IRB is basically a IRB for hire, if you will. In other words, instead of using the IRB that happens to come along with, you know, Harvard or Hopkins or whoever it is, you can use a commercial IRB. And again, Etienne, the precedent, the regulatory precedent for this is the third-party review for a 510K, where for certain kinds of medical devices, you don't have to have the FDA review your 510K. You can hire a separate company. It's what we call a third-party reviewer to ostensibly act as a surrogate, if you will, for the FDA. The same principle applies here with a commercial IRB. The commercial IRB has to be allowed by that particular institution. It has to be recognized by that institution. So it may very well be that one institution will allow you to use a commercial IRB if you want to, whereas another institution will not. That's totally up to them. But in most cases, because you're paying the IRB, just like you're paying a notified body, you have a certain expectation of you know, timely responses to your inquiries and so on and so on. So like everything regulatory, and there's advantages and disadvantages to both. The purpose of our discussion today is to try to point out what the different options are and some of those advantages and disadvantages. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I love the illustration with the 3P5, the third party 510K. That makes a lot of sense. One quick question on the advantages. If you have that commercial IRB route, can you potentially cast a wider net with institutions, assuming, you know, Stanford, Harvard, and Hopkins, just to use your examples, all accept perhaps that commercial IRB? Is that the case?
Exactly correct. And once again, kudos to you, because I think you know more about this than you give yourself credit to. One of the suggestions that I make to my customers is, if you're going to do a clinical trial in multiple sites, multiple locations, and most of the time, FDA typically likes to see multiple sites. Oftentimes, the magic number is three, at least three different clinical sites, but take that number with a big grain of salt. Anyway, if you can identify one commercial IRB that is recognized by all three of those sites, then you can kill, in this case, three birds with one stone. You get the blessings of that commercial IRB, and then that will be transferable to all those different sites. So that is if it's possible, it's not always possible to do that, but if it's possible in your particular case, that could be a very significant savings in terms of time and probably money as well.
And I know there's several other questions I want to get to. I want to ask one more follow-up question about that. And so, just to kind of use the example with FDA and pursuing my submission, there's the pre-sub process. When it comes to IRB, does it make sense to talk to them prior to just submitting your protocol, or is there some kind of process similar?
Yeah, great question. You're doing what my attorney friends like to say, leading the witness. So thank you for leading me. Terrific question. So here's the thing. A moment ago, I said that almost any time you're doing a clinical trial, certainly a clinical trial for a new medical device. When it comes to label expansions, that's a little bit different. But if it's a new medical device getting onto the market for the first time, you need clinical data, you will undoubtedly need permission of the IRB or multiple IRBs, depending on the number of institutions. Now the question becomes is, do you need permission of the FDA to begin a clinical trial? Do you want to take a guess at that one, Edian, since you seem to be on a roll there?
My guess is yes.
The guess, it's a good guess, but not quite. Let me give you a hint. What is the shortest, most accurate, and most succinct answer to every question in regulatory affairs? There's no exceptions, including this one.
Well, it depends.
It depends.
I want to throw a caveat. So this is... I actually tried to find something, but I couldn't quite figure out exactly where I was pulling this information from. So maybe you can just tell me, hey, you're off, or maybe you're right. You know, you tell me. For a while there, historically, my understanding was IRBs were accepting maybe too much because maybe I had a university hospital that benefited from some of these clinical trials and clinical investigations, and the FDA doing things that maybe the FDA wouldn't necessarily approve of. So a lot of IRBs are now looking at that and say, we'd like you to have that approved by the FDA first. So there's a little bit of a political backlash. I don't know if that's something that I'm just making up or if I...
No, I don't think you're making it up. I would spin it in just a slightly different way. Look, there's no question there's a potential conflict of interest here. Absolutely no question whatsoever, because any institution, even the most reputable medical schools in the United States, they are making money off of doing clinical trials. It's what we call the non-direct fees. And those can be very, very substantial. So for somebody to say that, you know, there's no financial incentive for an institution to want to do a clinical trial, I think is a bit naive, to put it politely. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that, of course, there are exceptions. But as a general rule, most IRBs, remember, their primary mission, their only mission in life, is to ensure the safety of the patients at that particular institution. I would like to think that no IRB would allow the potential for their institution to make money to come over to trump, you know, a possible safety risk, you know, when it comes to biocompatibility or electrical safety or something like that. But of course, as we both know, Eddie, and there are occasionally some, you know, some bad actors in this industry, and that's why we have regulation and that's why we have the FDA. But coming back to the original question, whether or not we need FDA permission to begin a clinical trial has to do with the risk of the device. And I've done podcasts with Greenlight before about the different systems for risk. Just as a recap, for example, we have here in the United States three different independent but also interdependent systems that we handle risk with. One is the classification system, class one, class two, class three. That system is what most people are familiar with. There's a second risk-based well, for the lack of a better term, classification system. It's what we call a significant risk versus a non-significant risk device. And that's the one that's applicable here. But the third system for risk is the medical device software classification system. These are three different independent, but also interdependent ways that we handle risk here in the United States. And while on one hand, as you and your audience probably know, Eddie, and I'm a subject matter expert for FDA in several different areas, one of them being risk. So this is a topic that I do know a fair amount about. On one hand, risk is a very complicated topic, much more complicated than a lot of people think. But on the other hand, maybe we go out of our way to make it even more complicated than it needs to be because we've got these three different systems for risk. Anyway, that's enough of the tangent. We can put a link to that particular podcast, SR versus NSR devices, in the podcast notes if people are interested. The reason why it's applicable here is because if your device is a significant risk device or an SR device, then you are required to get an IDE or an investigational device exemption prior to beginning your clinical trial. If your device, on the other hand, is a non-significant risk device or NSR device, you're what we call IDE exempt. And in that case, there's no obligation for you to go to FDA to begin your clinical trial first. You still have to go to the IRBs. You always have to go to the IRBs, but not to the FDA. But even though that's the regulatory requirement, Eddie, my advice to companies, and I do a lot of NSR devices, obviously, but even for companies that have an NSR device, and by the way, the determination of whether or not your device is significant risk or non-significant risk, that is up to the company. That is not up to the FDA, that is not up to the IRB, that is not up to anybody else, that's up to the company. Is that putting the fox in charge of the hen house? Absolutely, no question about it, but that's exactly what the regulation says. So even in the case where you have a non-significant risk device, I almost always recommend taking it to the FDA first, usually in the form of a pre-sub. What a guess as to why I recommend doing that, Eddie, even though it's not required. Why would a company take an NSR device to the FDA, usually as part of a pre-sub, when it's not required?
Well, personally, I would not want them to upclass that to a significant risk and then potentially invalidate whatever clinical investigation I'm performing.
Very good. So that's one of the two reasons why I make that recommendation. In other words, sort of a sanity check. Say, okay, Mr. and Mrs. FDA reviewers, here's our device. This is what it does. This is how it works and so on. For all of the following reasons, it is a non-significant risk device. And then FDA will say, great, you know, that sounds logical to us. Or they'll say, hold on a second here. We don't quite see it that way. And that's when the poker game begins. So reason number one that I recommend bringing NSR devices to the FDA, I don't bring it just as a standalone NSR question, but I usually embed it in an existing pre-sub, is to make sure that FDA sees it also as a non-significant risk device, because if they don't see it as a non-significant risk and you submit your 510K or de novo or whatever it is later on, now you're in a whole bunch of problems and you haven't even started talking about your device yet. That problem doesn't happen an awful lot, but it does happen from time to time. The second reason why I make the recommendation to take an NSR device to the FDA, even when it's not required, is to avoid a very common problem where a company does a clinical trial, they get, you know, approval of all the IRBs and everything else, they submit their 510K or the de novo or whatever it is, FDA says, this looks great, but we want, you know, this additional information. And now, you know, maybe they want some additional clinical endpoints or something like that, or a higher power of the trial or something like that. So now the company has to go back and in some cases to do a clinical trial all over again to collect that additional information. You don't need an MD or a PhD or an RAC after your name, Eddie, to appreciate ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. It's a very easy problem to mitigate, if not totally avoid, by taking it to the FDA first. But one last thing, and I'll be happy to let you chime in with questions, Eddie, because you're asking some great questions. Remember my regulatory mantra when it comes to communicating with the FDA, and that is, oh my gosh.
Tell, don't ask.
Thank you. Tell, don't ask, lead, don't follow. So please don't go into the FDA and say, do I need to do a clinical trial? Because, I mean, what do you think they're going to say? Of course, you need to do 10 million people or something like that. You say, we're not doing a clinical trial, and here are the reasons why. Or we are doing a clinical trial. This is what it's going to look like. This is the design. This is the inclusion and exclusion criteria. These are the endpoints, the power, the number of sites, and so on and so on. And FDA will come back and say, yeah, that sounds great. We look forward to seeing your results in a few months. Or they'll say, hold on a second here. You know, we don't quite see it that way. And that's when the poker game begins. So very long-winded response to your question, Eddie, and if you even remember what your original question was, but good question.
So kind of you answered the question. That was fantastic. I appreciate that. When do we need FDA permission for a clinical trial? Maybe on the flip side, what about IRB approval? When do I need IRB approval to begin a clinical investigation for my device?
Great question. So the easy part of the answer is, and I alluded to this earlier, if you're working on a brand spanking new device, a device that is not on the market here in the United States. It might be on the market in other places in the world, but not here in the United States, and you need to do a clinical trial, absolutely, you're going to need IRB approval, as we talked about earlier, and you're going to need IRB approval at each and every one of those institutions that you're going to be doing your clinical trial at. Whether or not you need FDA approval to do the clinical trial, that's going to be contingent on whether it's significant risk or non-significant risk, as we just talked about a moment ago. That's the easy part. That's the black and white part. The harder part, and this is where we get into the gray areas, and my favorite areas to play in are the gray areas, because it's not, you know, yes or no. It's not binary. There's matter of interpretation. Is, let's say, Eddie, and for the sake of discussion, you have a device on the market already for one particular indication. You, through your post-market surveillance, you start to learn of people using this device for another indication. Technically, that would be considered off-label use. But you and your company decide, you know what? That's a pretty good, you know, use of our device as well. For whatever reasons, it wasn't part of our original 510K or our original De Novo or our original PMA. But we think it would be a good idea to add that, because then we can advertise for that particular, what used to be an off-label use. And so let's do a clinical trial to collect the data. We could do real world evidence as well, but let's just focus on the RCT, the randomized clinical trial. Would we need an IRB approval for a device that's already on the market to do a clinical trial for an indication that is not currently on the FDA cleared or approved label? That's clearly in the gray area. The regulation does not say one way or the other. In that particular case, I revert to institutional policy. Remember, you asked earlier, Eddie, about the regulation that the IRBs follow. They all follow the GCPs, but like all regulation, they can be interpreted in different ways. I know I won't name specific institutions, but off the top of my head, I can give you a laundry list of institutions that, as a matter of institutional policy for their institution, if you want to do a label expansion, and this is true for drugs as well as medical devices, if you want to do a label expansion, if you want to add a new indication, they will still require an IRB approval. On the other hand, there are some, probably not a lot, but there are some institutions that are a little more liberal, if you will, and they basically say, well, once the product is approved by the FDA for something, people can use it for whatever they want. And so if you want to do a clinical trial, you know, on this other thing, then, you know, go ahead and do it. You don't need our particular permission. My advice to companies, though, is to find out, once you've identified which institutions you're going to do your clinical trials at, and that's a topic of a different discussion, but once you identify those, find out what their policy is for label expansions and doing a clinical trial of off-label use. But still, I think that it's probably, even though it might not be against the regulation not to get the IRB approval for an off-label clinical trial, I still think it's the right thing to do. It might not violate the letter of the law, but it would certainly violate the spirit of the law. And one other thing that I would just point out before we start to wrap this up, Eddie, is in those situations where your device is a non-significant risk device and you are what we call IDE exempt, and you do not have to go to the FDA prior to your clinical trial. I think it's a good idea to, but you're not required to. in that event, keep in mind that the only thing, how do I want to say this? The only thing standing behind the, standing between the patient and the safety of your device is the IRB. There is no FDA in this particular case. Keep in mind, and I personally think this is a weakness in the GCPs, of the good clinical practices, IRBs, because they exist at institutions like hospitals and medical schools and so on. They're for the most part clinical people and scientific people, not necessarily engineering people. So when it comes to issues like biocompatibility or electrical safety, these are things that are kind of assumed by most clinical people. But an engineer, a good biomedical engineer, I'm sure, I hope, would never make such an assumption, right? And so because you're not dealing with the FDA in this case, you're only dealing with the IRB, the review of the IRB is critical to the safety of the patient. We're not even talking about the efficacy of the device. We're talking about, you know, basic safety, like you plug something into the wall and you don't get electrocuted. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that's basic engineering, but you would like to think that that doesn't happen, but sometimes it does. So when you're only dealing with the IRB, I think there should be a greater burden on the company to really make sure that it's safe, because there is no FDA oversight in that particular case. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And you alluded to it at the beginning too, when you talked about risk management and how risk is one of the primary, you know, I was actually just looking at, before our conversation, 45 CFR part 46, which talks about requirements for institutional review boards. And I noticed that risk is mentioned 51 times. And so it's just really interesting. So I imagine someone listening to this might have the question, what information do I need to provide for the IRB for review? How long does the whole process take? You mentioned the difference between commercial and traditional, maybe that timeline being different, but what about those? What can people expect?
So great question. In terms of timeline, unfortunately, I can't give you, or I don't know of any national IRB statistics. If somebody does know, please share them with me. But I imagine they're going to vary all over the place, because IRBs vary all over a place. But here's one of the questions that I always recommend to my customers to ask when they're shopping around for individual institutions to do a clinical trial. Ask them about the mechanics of their IRB, for example. Who makes up their IRB? How often do they meet? Some IRBs will meet once a month. Some will meet once a quarter. Some will meet, you know, more frequently or less frequently than that. So, you know, if, for example, you're dealing with an IRB that only meets once every quarter, that's once every 90 days. If you just dumb luck happen to submit your paperwork the day after their last meeting, you're going to be waiting for 3 months before they even look at it. So those are legitimate questions to ask. And then finally, ask them for their particular institution, what is the average response time for coming up with a decision as to, yeah, this is approved to begin your clinical trial, or no, it's not. And ideally, that would be the icing on the cake. The flower on the icing on the cake would be, especially if you're dealing with a large institution that, you know, has multiple IRBs for different clinical specialties. If you're dealing with a cardiology product, for example, try to get statistics or information specific to cardiology. You're not probably interested so much in urology or OBGYN or some, you know, you're interested in cardiology. Or if you're working in neurology, asking them, you know, for the review statistics for the neurology IRBs, so that you can do that apples to apples comparison. So that's the timeline piece. In terms of the content, I have a template that I give to my customers when we're preparing, you know, to submit to an IRB. It's very similar to a lot of the information that you're going to submit to the FDA. For example, you have to have your device description, what your device does, how it works, its mechanism of action, and so on. You need to have, because the IRB is interested primarily in the clinical trial, you need to have your clinical trial protocol, what you're going to do to the patients, what you're going to be measuring, how much, if any, you're going to follow up, and so on. And by the way, you also have to usually include all of the collateral information that's going to come up, that's going to be exposed to the patient. For example, the informed consent form, that usually has to be part of your IRB package. Any kind of direct-to-patient or direct-to DTP advertising information. Sometimes the IRB might request that. So all that kind of information, probably the most important piece of information for the IRB, though, especially if it's a non-significant risk device, is your non-significant risk device justification. In other words, here's my device. This is what it does. This is how it works. For all of the following reasons, we have designated this as a non-significant risk device, and here are all the reasons why. I have had it happen, and actually just before the holidays, it happened very recently, where we have a device. In my opinion, it's a very, very legitimate non-significant risk device, but the IRB is wanting some conglomerate confirmation from FDA that FDA also sees this as a non-significant device. Non-significant risk device. Yes. The problem is there is no official document where that FDA will give you that'll say this is an NSR device, because they'll give you an IDE if it's an SR device, but there is no like a non-IDE, if it's not. And so we had to go back to the IRB and say, look, there's no regulatory requirement for us to give you a document from the FDA. Oh, by the way, we took it to the FDA as a pre-sub. And we can share with you our meeting notes where everybody seemed to agree that this is NSR. We can show you the other IRBs that we're dealing with where they never asked such a question for, proof that this is NSR. So again, because everybody is following the same rules, but they're not necessarily following or interpreting the rules the same way, you get different interpretations. And in that case, you can do whatever you can, Etienne, to try to come up with a meeting of the mind so that you could proceed and do your study there as planned. But if the end of the day, if they're saying that, hey, we need this piece of paper and you can't get this piece of paper, you say, you know what, Institution X, we would love to work with you, but quite frankly, you're being too difficult. We're going to go down the road and work with Institution Y, i.e. IRB shopping.
Right. And I know we talked about it a little bit. I might ask you a little bit more, but I just think that's interesting how the SR versus NSR, there seems to be a FDA sensitivity versus specificity when it comes to determining that. That's
good
interesting.
Pun.
Any other piece of advice when it comes to choosing that IRB? I mean, obviously, if you're going to an institution, you may be locked in with that institution if that's your goal. But any other thoughts or advice for companies shopping for an IRB?
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on the company. Specifically, what I mean is, what's more important to you, the institution name or the IRB? In some cases, especially if you're dealing with a brand spanking new technology, if you're, let's be honest, if you're, a Me Too 510K, or even, there's a lot of Me Too PMAs, even though they're class three, they're still PMAs. We have dozens and dozens of bare metal coronary stents. They're all basically the same. Yeah, they have slightly different designs in terms of the wires, or it's a wire versus a hypo tube or something like that. But at the end of the day, a bare metal coronary stent is a bare metal coronary stent. So what is more important, the name recognition of having like a really well-known medical school, an Ivy League school or something like that? And by the way, I teach in an Ivy League school. I'm not sure if Ivy League still means what it used to mean, but that's a topic for a different discussion. Or if it's better, if it's more important for you to work with an IRB that's going to be timely in their responses, that's going to be willing to work with you, to be helpful, as opposed to just being a barrier to say, no, you cannot do this. And instead, they have a more positive attitude, like, well, we think it would be more appropriate if you do it this way instead of that way or something like that. Exactly like working with a notified body, Eddie, exactly like working with the FDA. You want somebody that you can work together with as a part of your team. You shouldn't view the IRB, nor should you view the FDA as an obstacle, somebody to just, a barrier to just get over in order to get your product onto the market. Maybe that's a little naive. Maybe that only happens in the universe of unicorns and rainbows, but that's what I try to do. Am I successful all the time? No, not quite all the time, but I'm successful more often than not. As long as it's sound, as long as it's based on valid engineering and biology, the regulation, we can work that out. But the medicine and the biology and the engineering, that has to be sound first and foremost. If not, you're a snake oil salesman. It's as simple as that.
I keep going back, but I know this isn't a topic about risk management, but I keep thinking about, well, what are some of the mistakes, you know, in communicating companies could make in the evaluation of communication of that risk to IRB, you know, just similar that we talk about with FDA. But do you have any thoughts? I know with the FDA, for example, maybe one of the things that's beneficial with the submission is a cover letter and actually spelling that out so that they can have that in the back of their mind as they go through your submission. Is there something similar with an IRB or any other last piece of advice?
Well, I like to put, it's a great question, Eddie, and thank you for bringing it up. I like to tell a story. Obviously, this should be nonfiction, right? But still a story where you have an introduction, you know, a body, a series of main points, and then a conclusion. I remember many years ago, to improve my presentation skills, I was in a group called Toastmasters, and they had this expression, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you just told them. This is a practice that I use in my written communication as well. So whether I'm putting together a pre-sub for the FDA or a package, you know, for an IRB, I'm going to tell a story. I'm going to say, you know, here, start out with, here's my device. This is why I've developed it. And this is how it works. And this is what it's going to do. And this is how it kind of compares to other things out there. We're not talking about like a 300-page PhD dissertation, but, you know, a few paragraphs is sort of a background. And then, pardon me, the purpose of this document is to provide the information necessary such that, you know, that you believe that this is safe and appropriate to use in a clinical trial at your institution. And then you go into all of the different parts that you need to go into. And at the end of the day, you reiterate, you know, in this document, we presented the following information. One thing that I tell a lot of my customers, Eddie, and when it comes to the FDA, but it also applies to IRBs as well. We should not be so naive as to think that every FDA reviewer or every IRB member will read every page of your document cover to cover. It's just,
yeah,
maybe in the rainbow, in the universe of rainbows and unicorns, perhaps, but not in the real world. That just ain't going to happen. But usually most people will read the beginning, you know, the introduction, and then the ending, you know, the summary and the conclusion. And they might read, you know, a few parts in between. So this is the reason why, you know, sometimes, Mike, you're saying, well, you're repeating the same information. Well, a certain degree of repetition is okay. One of my frustrations with a lot of regulatory submissions, though, is they're so long, thousands or maybe tens of thousands of pages long. Why? Because the same information is being repeated over and over and over. I swear, these people, some people must be getting paid by the page rather than by the hour or something. I don't know. but a certain amount of repetition is okay. Too much repetition? No. That's not what I'm advocating here. Just like they used to teach in elementary school. I'm not sure if they still do. You know, write it like a story. You have an introduction. You have a series of main points. You have a conclusion. And then hopefully that'll be enough to do the job. If it's not, just like a submission to the FDA, they might come back to you with some questions and you can respond either via writing or having a meeting. It depends on the policies of that institution. I try to avoid going back and forth with a lot of reports and a lot of emails for all the obvious reasons. Once we make the original submission, if there are questions, I usually ask to have a meeting to discuss it to make sure that, you know, everybody is on the same page, because I've seen it happen many times where a company will answer the question that they think is being asked when in fact they're answering a totally different question, you know? And so obviously not only is that just a waste of time, but now you're introducing the possibility of creating new problems where no problems existed before, right? So for all those obvious reasons, I think looking for an IRB that's willing to work with you is good advice.
I love that. And I love the advice about storytelling. That's really applicable across pretty much every, you know, I had a professor in college who would tell us about Chekhov. I couldn't even tell you who Chekhov is at the moment. But I can remember the phrase where he said, if you put a gun on the wall in act one, it better get fired in act two. And so, don't just repeat yourself for no reason. I have a lot of takeaways today. I personally didn't know about the traditional versus commercial IRB. I really appreciate the 3P 510K example and to differentiate those two, as well as the SR versus NSR. We'll put links to those in the show notes. But yeah, this is a really good conversation. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm glad, as always, to have this opportunity to share this information with you and your audience. Regrettably, I see so many companies making, in some cases, the largest medical device companies on earth that have like hundreds and hundreds of regulatory folks on their team, you know, and they make some of the most basic, you know, the most elementary level, elementary school level mistakes. It's just, you know, so I'm happy to share the information. And, you know, rather than, you know, reiterating everything that we just talked about, I think the couple most important messages that people should come away with is, number one, if you're going to need clinical data for your medical device, and remember, not all devices do, most 510K devices, in fact, do not need clinical data. But if you are going to need clinical data, even if it's a non-significant risk device, as we talked about before, I think you're wise to vet that with the FDA in a pre-sub in advance first, even though you're not required to. Some companies take the attitude, well, we don't want to create a problem where none exists. And so they'll say, well, we're not going to we're not going to tell FDA about that. Well, I say, okay, fine, that's your decision. You don't have to. But here's the risk that you're taking. If you're going to do a clinical trial for your NSR device and you don't tell FDA about it first, and again, you have no obligation to, and you spring it on them for the first time at the point of the submission, then be prepared for them coming back and say, well, you know, what about this other endpoint? You didn't measure this endpoint. You know, we would like to see that. So now you may have to do a whole clinical trial over again in order to collect that information. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. You know, it's a calculated risk. Some companies might choose to take that risk. Other companies might not. The other thing that I think that people should be aware of is when you're dealing with institutional review boards or IRBs, keep in mind the word there is institution. Some of these institutions are very large, very bureaucratic, very political. I gave you the example of the stem cell, the product that I was involved with a few years ago. So don't underestimate the time and effort that it might take you to get this through that particular institution. And one of the things I always like to recommend to companies is if you can have a physician champion within that institution, somebody that's, you know, on staff, you know, in the medical school at that particular institution, for example, who's a big fan of your device, your technology, if they can help, I don't want to say grease the wheels, but if they can help, you know, move things along, so to speak, kind of like fiber, if you will, you know, through the bowels of the institution, that will help a lot, because some of the bureaucracy, it's just boggles the mind.
That was actually one of the things that came to mind when you were talking about label expansion and determining what institution to go to. I would think an institution that is using your device for that off-label use, that seems like it, well, depending on the liberality of the IRB, I suppose, you know, those could be two different things, but it seems like that could be at least a good starting point.
And here's an interesting statistic, more in the general clinical trial area as opposed to specifically with IRBs. But the single biggest reason, the most common reasons why clinical trials either don't finish on time or in some cases don't finish at all is because of lack of patient enrollment or lack of patient recruitment. So in that label expansion example that you just alluded to, Etienne, yeah, it makes perfect sense to go to an institution or at least include one of your institutions, somebody that is already using a lot of your devices, so that maybe patient enrollment is not as big of a challenge.
Yeah, great point.
If you work with an institution that's never used and is not familiar with your device, then recruitment obviously can be a little more of a challenge.
Well, this is really good. Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate you being on the podcast. Those you've been listening, you've been listening to the Global Medical Device Podcast. We thank you for being here and definitely check the show notes. We're going to have a lot of links and resources, and obviously feel free to reach out to Mike as well. We'll put his email in the link as well. He mentioned that template IRB package, so that could be a good resource to potentially reach out about. Thanks again for being on the show, Mike. We'll let you get back to it.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, can I ask a special favor from you? Can you leave us a review on iTunes? I know most of us have never done that before, but if you're listening on the phone, look at the iTunes app, scroll down to the bottom where it says leave a review. It's actually really easy. Same thing with the computer. Just look for that leave a review button. This helps others find us and it lets us know how we're doing. Also, I'd personally love to hear from you on LinkedIn. Reach out to me. I read and respond to every message because hearing your feedback is the only way I'm going to get better. Thanks again for listening and we'll see you next time.